Hey, what's up, guys? This is an awesome interview with Jose Luis Recon Fernandez de la Puente, or Arthur Kale on Twitter. And he runs one of my favorite blogs, Nintel, and it focuses on everything from economics, wildfires, to longevity. So, knowing me, this conversation was mostly focused on longevity. We talk about some research that he's starting to lead, the most important areas in longevity, what is needed in the longevity field, how he got into this, and more. So it's super exciting. Also, first podcast sponsor, this is sponsored by ZBiotics. So if you're drinking this summer and you want to use synthetic biology to prevent a hangover, definitely use code NASJAC for 10% off. I've used it and I was shocked at how good I felt the next morning. Without any further ado, let's get into the podcast.
Jose, how's it going, man?
Enjoying the California sun?
Yeah, it's good. I was in LA before this and I was like, okay, I'm close to SF. I might as well come back for a little bit. You were traveling around a bit, right?
Yeah, I've been to in the last month or two or so, I've been to Vegas, LA, Miami, New York as well, briefly, and I'm going to New York for the summer as well.
Nice, nice. Oh, so you're going back to New York too?
Yes, for the summer and all the way until September.
Okay, nice. Oh, wow. That's a long time. Do you have like a lab here or something, or do you just kind of do your research at your place?
Yeah, no, in my place. All the lab stuff, that's all subcontracted for the thing you were doing.
Okay. Oh, okay. So you just hire labs to do experiments for you?
Has not happened yet. I don't want people to get the impression that I'm running around doing like 10 things at once. This is like one thing. It's a big thing, but it's one. It's happening soon, but not yet.
Okay. So you're getting all the pieces in place.
Yeah, so I guess maybe for a bit of explanation. So there is this big study that I've been working on for, depending on how you measure it, for a year or for a few months. A year ago, I got the idea like, hey, it would be nice if we did this. But then that was just a Google Doc. And then last year, it started becoming, actually, we could do this, actually. So I joined forces with Adam Marblestone. Another reason we began thinking more seriously about what the field needed. So we also talked to a bunch of people in the longevity space, from David Sinclair to Aubrey de Grey, like the whole range. We scoped one such project that could be interesting to fund. We got feedback from them. Everyone liked the idea. Then we went to a lab. We got a quote. Now we are arguing over the quote. I had to do some negotiation there. And importantly, we got a CEO for this project, as in our, you can think of Adam and I perhaps as being like a two-man DARPA, as in we go about making things happen, but we don't ourselves either put the money from our pockets or we don't actually run the projects. We make them happen, but then they go on their own. So we got a CEO for this as well as funding for the project. The source refers to remain not publicly known for the time being, but will be known eventually as soon as the project is officially launched.
Okay. One thing, I have two questions. One thing, can you move your camera a little bit down so we could maybe see a little bit more of you? Because I'll put this on YouTube as well. And then two, can you talk about what that project is?
Yeah. So the project that I've been working on, we call it the Rejuvenome, from rejuvenation and like genome or epigenome, Rejuvenome. Mm-hmm. And the idea here, or the motivating idea, is that there are many studies that claim to rejuvenate or slow down aging or reverse aging in mice or in other models. But these studies sometimes they don't measure, or it's difficult to know exactly to what extent these interventions are actually working. For example, one study maybe gives some doses of rapamycin, which is one drug, mm-hmm. to mice, and then they will measure their lifespan and also their changes in their liver transcriptome plus something else. Let's say NAD levels. Okay, mm-hmm. So in that case, the study may show that the liver looks younger and that NAD levels went up, which makes sense because most of the NAD that is not made by cells is made in the liver. Good. But then did that do anything to the immune system or to the brain or to the muscles? We don't know because the paper didn't look into that.
Is it pretty difficult to measure what happens in those other systems?
It's not so much difficult. It's expensive. So the more things you want to measure, the more expensive it gets. So if you're doing research about brain aging, you are measuring typically brain stuff. You're measuring things about the muscles. So you're thinking this drug and this system, but you're not thinking what else is this drug actually doing in my system, in the whole organism. In humans, so for example, another example of this might be this paper that came out 2 or 3 years ago from Greg Five. This is the one where they use growth hormone plus DHEA and metformin to regrow the thymus in humans. And they reported that by some measure and epigenetic clock that they reverse aging. But then again, we are left with the same question. How comprehensive was that? Because ultimately, the BMT clock that then people use is based on the methylation that you're looking at is methylation of T cells from your blood. It's like, well, okay, sure, those look jammed because the thymus did grow and it's active. But what about everything else? We don't know.
So that's just using the Horvath clock, right? And also, I made a video about this, actually. I made a TikTok about it. I'll link it below.
Oh, cool. Yeah. So this is not exactly the Horvath clock. I mean, apparently at this point, there are multiple Horvath clocks. Conceptually, the idea of clocks 101 is that by looking at the state of the epigenome, in this case, it's you can think of the epigenome as in some positions in the DNA, you have these CpG sites, which are sites where you can have one or not have a methyl group like CH3, one methyl attached to the DNA. And then you can just train a model based on, let's say, thinking in data science terms, you'd have your columns would be if there is or not a methyl in that group, and then each row would be one patient, and then you can train based on that set of vectors. These models are typically simple. They are glorified linear regressions, nothing fancy here. And then you can predict age or mortality. You can train these clocks to either predict age, and this is what the original Horvath clock was doing, or you can train them to predict how much time you have left until you die. Mm-hmm. And then you can use different data sets for robustness. The original clock, for example, the original Horvath clock was using a data set that was longitudinal. So it's like you get some young people, some old people, you put everyone together, and then you use that. But the problem is that people that age too fast, they die and they drop out. So you don't see them in your data set. Mm. So in a way, you are it's biased in some way. So more recently, there are other clocks like Grim Age or Fino Age. Grim Age, which is Morgan Levin, which are more accurate. Actually, a Grim Age is more accurate than knowing if you smoke or not. So, if I could choose between asking you, do you smoke or not, or give me your methylation to see if you're going to die, it's like, yes, give me your methylation. I don't care if you smoke.
Okay, but Horvath clock isn't better than knowing if you smoke or not.
Horvath, I'm not sure.
Or like the original.
I didn't look into that one. Horvath aims to predict age. And then you can say, well, if you're supposed to be 25, but you're actually the clock says 28, you are older by the so you're aging faster, and you can try to infer mortality from their health. But the newer clocks are directly trying to predict mortality without having to predict age. But they're all conceptually the same. They may be measuring different sites. It all depends on the data set and some intermediate things about this. I also wrote a blog post on all these clocks as well, so I guess we can.
Yeah, I think, was that the epigenetics one?
Yes.
I was just reading that before this. So What if you take like all of these clocks and use them in the same study? Like, is this what you're doing with the mice? Like, are you using all of the clocks or?
Well, no. So actually in the Fahy paper, they did look, they did use a number of clocks at the same time. They use Grim Age, which is the state of the art, but also Fino Age and other clocks for robustness. Clocks is one of the things you can look at. You can also look directly at like single cell transcriptomics of 20 different tissues, and you can look at proteins that are in blood. You can also look at things like cell-free DNA. As for example, there's a startup called Grail, that they're doing this in humans to predict cancer just from your blood. You get some blood, you look at the content of cell-free DNA. This is like sometimes when cells die, their DNA just leaks out into your blood and it's floating around.
Okay.
That DNA tells you, the methylation is still on that fragment of DNA, and that can tell you something about where that DNA came from and the state of the cells. So you can know that there are cancerous cells in your liver just from your blood.
Huh. So in your blood, is that cancer throughout your body or is that only in specific places in your body?
No, they're using it for early screening. So suppose that there is a small, tiny cancer in your pancreas that's starting to grow. And actually, the pancreatic cancer is the most difficult cancer of all to treat. The mortality rate is huge. It's the 90% or mortality within 5 years.
And is that because it's difficult to treat or difficult to detect? So then most people, it's like advanced when they detect
it. Exactly. It's the former. So it's difficult to detect. So by the time you see it, it's like because also of where it is, it's too late. I guess the opposite would be melanoma. So if you have a skin cancer and you're lucky, it's very easy to treat, as well as colon cancer if you can get it early, detect it early. And it's easy to detect because it's, in a way, it's on the outside of your body. Topologically, it's on the outside.
Yeah, you can see it.
Yeah, you can see it.
And access it, yeah.
Yeah. So sometimes, even when it's small, some of these cancer cells, they may leak some of that DNA to the outside that makes its way to your blood, and you can actually detect it. So they are using this for early screening. So you could measure.
And do you know where it originates? That's pretty interesting.
Yeah, because as a part of the methylation, ultimately, the genome in most cells, in all cells, with exception is, for example, at T cells, they had to do some recombination to be able to express lots of T cell receptors. But most cells, the DNA is the same. What changes is the epigenome, which switches on and off different genes depending on cell type. Mm-hmm. So with that, you can see, oh, this looks like the pattern of the kidney, but then it looks weird because it's overexpressing this particular gene, which is not supposed to be on, so it must be like a cancer. So, and then they try to predict cancer from that. Mm-hmm. But in any case, so this is all going back to things that you could measure. You could also look at body weight. You could look at urine. And you can also look at functional assays. You can take, for example, mice and get them running and see how fast they can run, or you can make tests of visual acuity, cognition. And ultimately, our study design is very stupidly simple. It's let's measure all the things with an asterisk, not literally all the things, but a lot in a way that has not been done before. So we do have right now in my things people call atlases. These are like very comprehensive data sets that look at aging as it unfolds over time. Like they take a cohort of mice and then they sample them over time. And one example of this is called it's called a tabula muris sinis. From Latin, it means like the old mice table or atlas. But the problem of this analysis is that it's difficult to understand from a causal point of view what's going on. Since you see correlations and you think what changes with aging, but you don't see what is causing what. You see that everything is degrading, but what is causing the degradation of what? Is it the brain causing something in the... So the with the rejuvenome, we are combining this idea of having a very comprehensive deep phenotyping profiling of mice with interventions, like lots of interventions, maybe up to 15. So for example, we take mice, wait until they're old, you give them rapamycin, you measure before and after, you get an idea of what happened to each mice. Because again, you're looking at blood, so you can get some idea from that. Plus, you can get the tissues after the interventions and then do single cell on them. And then you can say, okay, well, rapamycin fixed A, B, and C, but didn't do anything for, let's say, the system, or it didn't do much or a lot on this one. Okay, so then, and then we try something else, and it turns out maybe this one is good for everything that rapamycin is not good for. So then what if then, ideally, we can find some metric of aging that then you can combine interventions. Mm-hmm. Yes. I guess an example of this, so Google, for example, the way you might do this, how do you combine like single cell data with how fast a mouse can run into a single... So what they do is to feed all of this data to an autoencoder. It's a machine learning model that can basically you feed it data, then it tries to compress the data into a bunch of discrete numbers, let's say into 30 numbers, and then it tries to reconstruct that data out of from that small set of numbers. And the idea being that it's trying to compress and find a compressed representation of all that. In a way, it's like doing principal component analysis, but fancier. And then ideally, we can find a number of sort of number from this that represents aging in general, or maybe system-based aging. Mm-hmm. And then we can use this approach to see exactly what works together. So initially, we are not committed to a given fixed set of interventions. We have a number of things we want to try. And then we want to, depending on what happens with these metrics, we will iterate and combine them and see if we can get super long-lived mice.
So do you have any guesses on how long you'll be able to make the mice live, like with all these combinations?
I mean, the record, the benchmark to beat is 50%. That's with a gene knockout of a growth hormone receptor at like small mice that live longer. Mouse typically lives 36 months, 3 years, and 18 months. It's a very old, like 60-year-old human, but in mice. 50% might be, I would think, to aim for. We might not get there. Maybe, I think rapamycin might be like 20 or 10%, like rapamycin alone.
Are you also going to test, is one of your tests going to be knocking out the growth hormone gene?
Probably not. We are trying to think of things that eventually might make it to humans. I guess, for example, rapamycin, you could give it to a human. It's a drug that human that can be taken, for example, already taken for immunosuppression. And some people take it off-label for longevity.
For longevity, yeah.
Although I guess asterisk here, do not do it without medical supervision because your immune system won't like it. For example, you could, for example, genetically engineer a mouse to live a bit longer. But once you are an adult human, you cannot just go and genetically engineer
yourself. You can't knock out growth hormone in a human.
You could do, though, you could deliver a non-integrative gene therapy. There are some gene therapies already at the FDA level that are trying to some of these. For example, something I was tweeting about the other day is this company called Verve Therapeutics. And what they're working on is on a gene therapy that effectively knocks out an enzyme called PCSK9, the outcome of which being that it can radically lower your LDL cholesterol, which in turn, it's almost like a vaccine against cardiovascular disease. And cardiovascular disease is the the first or the second major cause of death in most developed countries, along with cancer. Mm-hmm. So in this case, you are doing gene editing in humans, but then it's more difficult to do, and they're not editing literally every single cell, a number of them.
Are they FDA approved, or how far have they gotten?
They are on phase 2 and phase 3. The data study in chimpanzees, and I recall, so in primates, so it's already pretty much it's working. And we know it's probably going to be safe because there are some people that naturally they have this mutation, they have super low LDL and they seem to be fine. And it's like, well, I guess this is one of the other quick wins that you could do in longevity. Is like some people naturally are more long-lived than others. Some people develop early Alzheimer's or they have like familial high cholesterol. If we know that the genetic causes of this, then we can just edit or
just do that.
You can do it in an integrative way, or you can deliver via AAVs, or these adeno-associated viruses that can temporarily modify or express some genes or interfere with expression of some genes, and do it, and then you get maybe you get some extra longevity. Although in this case, you could argue that you are not treating aging; you are treating a very narrowly defined cause. You're just treating LDL. But then it's still a huge thing.
But then, so they pass the filter through like heart disease, and then they eventually maybe get to brain disease or cancer is what takes them out.
Yeah, exactly. It's that you won't radically extend lifespan a lot. You will like maybe get 3 extra years of average lifespan at the society level, which is huge. But yeah, I mean, we also need to work on all the other things. So if you cure cancer and heart disease, and maybe you get some extra years, and then you have to keep going. The aging approach is what I call the one-to-n approach, where you are with one drug or one compound, you're addressing multiple diseases at once. And then conversely, you have the end-to-one approach, which is the combination approach, where for one disease, try, or for many as well, you could do end-to-end, you try a combination. And combinations are rare. And one of my points I've been making over the past few months in the longevity discourse is we should try more combinations. Mm-hmm.
So you don't think we've tried enough combinations. So then your study is trying to find a combination that works in mice, and then you'll eventually, will you go to humans, or what will you go to next? Like primates or dogs or?
The genome is only in mice. It's a scope to work just in mice. The output would be a data set, and this project is structured so that once it's over, in principle, it's over, and then it will be a different project to pick it up from there. But yeah, I mean, in principle, the thing with humans is that to go in as much depth as we want to go, you would have to, like, are your volunteers going to be okay with sampling their brains, their livers, their pancreas, their muscles? Probably not.
Yeah.
But one thing we maybe develop from this study is if we can predict function or state of the organs based on blood, then maybe you could lead to humans. You could give a therapy to a human and measure the blood and then measure if their pancreas has been rejuvenated from their blood, which is an easy measurement to take. Mm-hmm. So then, but we need to validate in mice if we can actually do this. How much can we tell just from your blood about organ-specific health?
So mostly it's like these tools that you need to quantify aging. I was reading, is there a way to measure aging in your brain through like brainwaves? So you don't have to take tissue samples?
It might be. I have not read much into that. I know there is a protein that it's a neurofibril tangles or NFTs for short. The other NFTs, which correlate with Alzheimer's incidence. There's a paper on that. So this is one of the ones you could use, for example, for brain aging. There is one protein called troponin that you find high levels of that when you have heart disease. But then you could keep going to more fine-grained ways. For brainwaves, I'm not sure. Maybe it probably makes sense that you should be able to do that.
Yeah, I think the reason that I read that is you were tagged in like a paper that somebody posted on Twitter, and they were like, "Hey, what do you think about this?" And then I think you said you'd look into it. So
I mean, sometimes I add things to the look into it stuff. Sometimes I look into it, but then I forget. Sometimes I'm like,
totally.
I have other things to read.
Yeah, yeah. So like, what tools? What, speaking of like measuring aging, what tools do you really want? Like, what do you wish we had?
So one of the things that I'd like to see is something we have been calling the LDL of aging. So if you want to approve a drug that will treat cardiovascular disease or atherosclerosis, you don't want to wait 50 years with two cohorts and wait and see how many people get stroke and then approve the drug after 50 years.
Yeah.
You want to say we reduce LDL or inflammation or whatever. And on the basis of this, the FDA says, cool, we can reliably predict that your drug will actually help with the disease. So we'll approve it after 1 or 2 years. Mm-hmm. We don't have that for aging, but the idea here would be to find something that such that lowering that or modulating that will have an impact on multiple diseases at once. So that would be the one thing that we want to find. You have to do it in humans to be reliable. Another tool, because I guess ultimately to go to the meta level, in my view, what slows down science in general historically has been noisy data. Some people argue about endlessly about, is that with clear data? More often than not, especially in biology, disagreements just dissolve because the data is clear. And also tools to generate the data in a cheap an efficient way. Clocks. So currently we have clocks that predict mortality. You could also develop other sort of clocks or more broadly predictors of organ-specific function clocks. I guess, for example, suppose that we had clocks for humans and you can go to a website and do a test. And there's actually some websites that might do that already. You are 26 as per your epigenome and you're like, cool. And then you do some exercise, you do some fasting, whatever, you take something.
Yeah.
You go back and then turns out now you are 24 and you're like, cool. But then what? It's like that in a way, directionally, you're going in the direction, but why? Was it, or rather, is there something that has not changed? Is your brain younger now, or is it the same, or is your pancreas? So you want
did
like
you read more, or like what did you do?
Yeah, so you want to be organ specific to be able to be more actionable, to be more fine grained into what you're doing. And again, it goes back to the. Being able to predict from blood about the state from all these different organs. So that's another tool. And there are also more like broadly other tools that you could think. For example, if you want to do gene therapy, you may want to have better vectors for gene therapy to be able to deliver bigger payloads into cells. I guess if you think, for example, of mRNA vaccines as a tool, basically getting mRNA into cell and then getting the cell to make the protein you want to get there. And you cannot get a protein easily into a cell, but you can get cell to make it, and then yes, it's just there. You could also use that for other things, and actually Moderna is thinking of using it for cancer treatment. But you could also use it for any other. If you think protein X, if you want more of it because it's good for longevity, well, now you can get cells to make it with this technique.
But the problem is like delivery location. So if you need it in your lungs, like how do you get it to your lung cells?
Yeah, that's another one. So I think Moderna and Cintali, they're working on one for the lungs and you'll inhale. But yes, typically the problem with many of these gene therapies is that they either go everywhere or they don't go to enough cells, and you want to get them to go and to be expressed where you want. For example, maybe you want a particular therapy to just go just to your brain, and because everything else is really fine, you just want to touch the brain. And that's been worked on right now by a bunch of labs. I believe the Sinclair lab, as well as the lab in Lausanne, they are working on that. Yes, those are some. And maybe one more might be being able to, just like right now, we can do multiple gene edits at once, like maybe CRISPR has evolved beyond the earlier stage. Doing the same with the epigenome, like getting epigenome editing to the point where genome editing is right now. So be able to, for example, if you think like, well, what if we take these clocks or the CpG sites that these clocks are picking up, and we take a young mouse, and then we flip the sites that we edit them to be exactly the way they look like in an old mice. And then similarly in an old mice, we make them look like in a young mice, as in without any, or in, as in without any intervention, just like flipping those switches. What happens next? Are these things causally causing aging? Can we get a mouse that looks young today in a week to look super old or something like that?
Well, it's metabolic rate slow down. Like, is that one of the questions? Yeah, totally.
No, what will happen? Do they, because maybe you do this and then the methylation marks go back to what they were when they were young. So maybe they're actually not causing, they were like a reporter of something else.
Something else is like the base system that's controlling it.
Yeah, I guess, for example, here's one example. Suppose that the actual root cause of aging is just DNA damage, supposedly, which I don't think is true, but like suppose someone said that.
Sure.
Okay, so then if a cell suffers DNA damage, then the cell is trying to fix it. So it's going to upregulate mechanisms to fix the damage. And that upregulation, you're going to see it in the epigenome. The epigenome is kind of the switches that the cell can flip on and off to regulate various processes. Mm-hmm. And so if you do the clocks, you're going to see that all cells have these genes, and you can make a clock and you can see that all these cells are a clock. But then when you try to revert those methylations, what you're doing by reverting that is switching off the repair mechanisms. So if switching off the old to the young state, you're actually making it age faster because you're switching off that repair systems. There are various competing ideas of what these methylation marks mean. Morgan Levine and her lab, they're working on figuring out what this actually means. So yeah, and I guess that ultimately understanding what these clocks actually mean and being able to causal, to show mechanistically what these sites do is the first step in getting the FDA to say, hey, these clocks are actually for real. And if we manage to show a decline or a reduction in epigenetic age, then you should maybe approve this drug for longevity and so without waiting 50 years.
This will massively increase the iteration rate of biology.
Yeah, and that you can both as a biotech you can have feedback faster. You can just see in a small trial what you did, but also when you're doing the actual longer trials, you need perhaps a smaller sample or shorter follow-up, so they are less expensive, so you can risk more. And maybe we'll see more companies trying things once it's cheaper to try and validate longevity interventions.
Mm-hmm. So this changing the epigenome, this is like reprogramming. Is this what everybody means when they talk about reprogramming?
Yes and no. It's like there is no, in the sense that you can change. It's possible to change those marks without reprogramming. There is like directly switching them on in a way, hard coding them.
Okay.
This thing is zero, now it's one in a very targeted way. Reprogramming.
What's it called when you do it in a targeted?
Epigenetic editing, I would say.
Okay. And that's not using CRISPR, but it's essentially CRISPR for the epigenome.
Yeah, I mean, I think they may share some techniques, some similar techniques. So the Cas9, for example, you may use in CRISPR. It can basically position, it can go to where you want it to go, and then you can attach other things to that Cas. And for example, in CRISPR, it's Cas plus a guide RNA. But then you could possibly imagine other proteins or other RNAs that can do something else. I think there's a recent method called CRISPR off and CRISPR on, mm-hmm, that can do epigenetic editing, for example.
Okay. Sorry, go ahead.
I was going to rant about reprogramming.
Well, I was before we get into reprogramming, when your epigenetics change, I guess like I'm trying to visualize this, you know, I understand like the DNA strand. When your epigenetics change, does the DNA strand change or what exactly changes?
Yeah. So it's like, think of it, the DNA is a double helix. This double helix is wrapped around this group of proteins called histones. These are like little balls and it's like wrapped against the histones. The histones have tails, and then the following can happen. So the DNA itself can have, mind that you take it at a given site, and then you attach a CH3 group, a methyl, you attach it there, and then you have this methyl hanging around from the DNA. That's it. These are the CPG sites that the clocks are picking up. But then there are also non-CPG modifications. So these histones, on these tails they have, they can have all sorts of things, like they can have acetylation or methylation and other sorts of modifications in these histones. So all of these, what all of these things do is when you're adding these molecules there, you are doing things like, well, physically now you have an extra chemical group in there, which has its own charge. So this causes the DNA to open up or to wrap up and coil up in different ways. And this changes is what is regulating gene expression. So I guess let's say this is a DNA strand, this finger, mm-hmm, and then if you get it to, and if there's one gene here in the middle, if you put, let's say, some methylation mark or take it out and you get it to coil up, the gene that was here, now it's not accessible. It cannot be transcribed. So you're going to see a activity of that gene. It's purely in a kind of a very mechanical way, just playing with the shape of the DNA.
So epigenetics is essentially like hiding and showing genes, like physically hiding and showing genes.
Yeah, basically that's the idea.
Okay.
In different ways. So for example, I guess another way you might do this is that the gene itself might be accessible, but to actually express the gene, you need other region called a promoter to be accessible. But maybe if you make that one not accessible, then the gene, even though it's accessible, is not being transcribed. So there are all sorts of things that you can play with. But this is the idea. So okay. The DNA sequence is the same. You're just adding changes on top of the DNA sequence. That can be important. That can be reversibly modified. So the cell can remove or add these marks. It's a very dynamic system, unlike with the DNA that's meant to stay the same for all the time.
Okay. Sorry, can you hear the people behind me?
Not really.
Okay, perfect. Sorry, some of my friends just came home. I'm going to tell them that I'm on a podcast. But okay, so do you want to get into the reprogramming?
Yes. So reprogramming is a specific kind of way of affecting changes in the epigenome. So back in 2012, Shinya Yamanaka got a Nobel Prize for being able to make any cell type into stem cells, into a so-called induced pluripotent stem cells. And he did this by this cocktail of four factors for proteins, collectively known as OSKM. Each, for example, M stands for c-MYC, O stands for OCT4, K for KRAS, I think. Well, I don't know exactly what this all stands for. But it is that years later, someone thought, well, what if you apply these factors to some cell? But instead of going all the way to when the cell becomes a stem cell, you go like halfway, like only a little bit. And then what happens? Well, what happens is that the cell seems to by a bunch of measures, be younger or more functional. Or for example, if you lose to a senescent cell, in some cases, the senescent cell stops being senescent.
So just to clarify, a senescent cell is an aging cell. So then you do this to an aging cell and it's you don't make it necessarily a pluripotent stem cell. You just make it closer to a stem cell.
Well, a senescent cell is a specific kind of aged cell, a cell that generates lots of inflammation around it. Typically, it's a cell that has been damaged and the cell itself goes into that state where it generates inflammation to signal that, hey, please clear me up to the immune system. But when they stick around for too long, they can generate too much inflammation. When you reprogram, when you give it these factors to these cells, they seemingly go back to normal, which is kind of puzzling.
It makes them just into a normal cell, not necessarily like a young cell.
No, into a normal young cell, into a cell that looks like and behaves like a young cell.
Okay. Can you see the age of these cells?
You can use clocks. There are also cell-based clocks that you could use for this purpose, as well as you can look at the transcriptome to see what difference there is with the younger cells. And sure, this is not perfect. This is not 100% distinguishable from a young cell, but it's surprising. For example, if you have let's say you take a cell and you have one given age, and then if you do full reprogramming to be committing the stem cell, the age goes to almost like zero, as in almost fully rejuvenated, looks fine. If you go halfway, it doesn't quite go to young state, but it goes some way there. So reprogramming, the idea here is that these factors are doing something. We don't fully understand exactly what it is that they are doing. It seems to have, this is mediated through changes to the epigenome. Which changes exactly happen, we don't know. We don't control them. Just like put these factors in there, something happens. We don't know exactly which sites are being activated, and then the cell gets younger. Now, it's a younger cell that maybe that doesn't mean anything or much. So there's this paper from 2016 from Alejandro Campo, who was then doing a postdoc at the Salk Institute at the Instituto Belmonte lab. Mm-hmm. And what they did was to genetically engineer mice to express this set of genes, these OSKM factors, in all tissues of the mice when mice were given an antibiotic known as doxycycline. So mice are fine, they are just regular mice. When you give this antibiotic, all their cells begin to produce OSKM and these factors, okay, and they can reprogram. And now if you do this, if you just give them this single all every day, the OSKM reprogramming goes too far, cells become stem cells, they become tumors, they go out of control and the mice die. But if you do it periodically, like maybe today and then maybe in 3 days and maybe days after that, the mice live way longer. And this is, by the way, they did this in fast aging mice. They was mice that were, there's that so-called progeroid mice that age faster and they live longer. They also looked at things like muscle function and glucose response and various other things, and everything looked rejuvenated. It's like, wow, what's going on here? So that got lots of interest. There's also a recent paper from the Sinclair lab that got to the cover in Nature, and they did this in, whereas the Ocampo paper was using genetically engineered mice, this one was using viruses. So they delivered these factors without modifying the mice. So they took their eyes, they crushed their optic nerve so they couldn't see, and then they injected these factors into the eye to try to get the nerve to grow back and restore vision. And it worked. And so they,
no way.
Yeah, the nerve typically doesn't grow back on its own, but they got it to actually regenerate and restore some amount of vision.
So, but when you crush a nerve, that doesn't necessarily, does that make it a senolytic cell? Like when you crush it, when you, because it's like a crushed cell, so then it's kind of destroyed?
It could. So it's like when you cause damage to a cell, many things can happen. You can have apoptosis, which is the cell dies in an orderly way and it gets cleared up. Then you have necroptosis, which is the cell just like pops up and then in a random way it spills its contents and it's a huge mess. Mm-hmm. And then you have senescence, in which the cell stays around, still a cell, but it's generating lots of inflammation. And it probably, for example, when you cut your arm and you get a wound, you were probably getting all three kinds of damage.
Okay, so it does cause senescence when you physically crush something or like cut it.
Mostly, it will cause some senescence, they will get cleared up. Actually, senescence may actually help with wound healing. So, if one of the positive things they have is that they may help with wound healing. Another interesting thing that in this study is that they measure also the epigenetic age of various cells around where they deliver the reprogramming in that mice, and they look younger after reprogramming
in the optical nerve.
Yeah, but I guess the most interesting finding is that the mice could see again. It's like they restore vision to blind mice.
Yeah, that's amazing. So do you think the treatment was like when they cut the optical nerve, do you think the treatment was affecting the senescent cells that were remaining and then they like became younger, kind of like stem cells, and then rejuvenated, or and then
in this case it's different. So they were able to image the optic nerve before. So you had in this case, you see, for example, optic nerve here, and then nothing in between because they had chopped in that section. And in this case, there was the cells that comprised the nerve were just dead. They were just not there. Mm-hmm. What they did is to actually physically to cause the nerve to grow back, to like new cells were growing back and then joining back the rest of the nerve to enable vision.
Wow, that's amazing. That, you know, that reminds me of bioelectricity, where like Michael Levin stimulated an eye on the spine of a tadpole, stuff like that, where he induced, you know, an optic nerve to grow on the spine. That kind of reminds me of that.
Yeah, I think Michael Levin's stuff is wild. And I think that if you wanted to get anyone excited about biology, I would definitely recommend them to check out Michael Levin's work. Yeah. Yes.
Yeah, I have a video on it and I definitely need to get him on the podcast too. But maybe, yeah, but that just reminds me of stimulating maybe those bioelectrical growth factors or growth pathways. I really don't have the language to to like say exactly what's happening or what I think is happening there.
Yeah, with the bioelectrics, so I guess the this is one of these weird ideas that was proposed a long time, maybe 1917 or something like that, by some random Soviet scientist. Mm-hmm. Back then it was called the morphogenetic field. I think that there might even be a Wikipedia article about this.
Yep.
And it was dismissed as pseudoscience. And maybe back then there was no technology to measure this sort of thing. But then Michael Levin, just like Ed Boyden and others, he likes to read all papers, mm-hmm. all ideas that maybe didn't make it back then. Maybe they were a bit crackpotty, but maybe there was something to them. And then he has been doing research on questions that initially we are not surprised, but maybe we should be. I guess, for example, if you take embryos, well, embryos start at a single cell, and somehow the cells know how to organize themselves into a full organism. Mm-hmm. How did it happen? Or, for example, when you cut a leg from a lizard or some lizards, it grows back. How does it know? It has to create all these fingers and all these structures at the tip of this new limb. Where is that information encoded? Mm-hmm. Or maybe this is a Levin's favorite example. These worms called planarians, but when you chop them in half, you end up with this worm, one worm with head and no tail, and one tail without head, and then somehow the headless tail grows a head, and the tailless head grows a tail. How does it know? It has to make the correct shape. It gets worse or more wild if you take deer or elk. These like animals that have like horns that they fall off every year, and they grow new ones. When they grow new ones, they grow in the same shape every year. How does it know that? Michael Levin's work is on this precise question. How does it know? Because ultimately, could it be that we could just take a regular human? Maybe this could be a publication for war veterans that have lost limbs. And could you actually get limbs to grow back in humans? Mm-hmm. Now, this might have sounded bonkers years ago, but now it's like, why not?
No, I mean, I've been saying that I think we'll have regenerating human limbs within the decade. Honestly, given the pace of Michael Levin's research, that's what I believe. one of my moonshot ideas.
I guess it seems that it hasn't moved from being completely bonkers to being within the realm of the possible. Maybe it becomes more of an engineering question. I think we have a proof of concept that some animals do it as a matter of fact. Mm-hmm. And then it's like a matter of why can't we? And then Levin also makes the point that very young humans can, if you cut their tips of the fingers, those can also grow back. So yeah. It's not like we have fully lost that ability. So now we need to see exactly how they do it and then get ourselves mm-hmm. to do it.
Yeah, the way that I understand it is mostly like as we age, then if we cut ourselves, then our bioelectricity patterns go into like the scarring process. But it's just a matter of changing the bioelectricity at the wound to initiate the like young growth patterns, the youth patterns.
Yeah, I think I've been wanting to write a longer article on how all this works, on how exactly in the context of biology, what does a bioelectric field mean and how this works. Maybe guess as a starting point. So we know that neurons, for example, when we think electricity or computation, we think neurons, right? So neurons have these channels by sodium or potassium, but all cells have them as well. It's not just neurons. So all cells can also import and export these ions and generate voltage differences between them and the outside. And maybe we ignore these, thinking that, well, maybe, I don't know, but maybe actually cells were doing some sort of environment sensing using these before they eventually neurons
developed into neurons. Yeah, so neurons are just more specialized forms of those early cells.
Yeah. So I guess the question is now, what are the other cells exactly doing? How are they cooperating or collaborating into all sorts of weird computations? Like, I guess, like, going back to the example of our linear regeneration, how can we decode something? How can we decode from when you cut the leg from a lizard? How can we decode the fact that there's supposed to be some fingers at the end and it has to be this length? How is that encoded in the bioelectrics or somewhere else? Maybe cells have some like RNA-based memory of some sort. I think it's definitely, if there is some kind of research from where you could expect to see a kind of breakthrough level field-defining achievement in biology, this seems to be one of those.
Yes. Do you think it will have any impact on longevity research?
Yeah, I think so. And incidentally, I've gotten some aging researchers in contact with Levin because it seems that there are some interesting applications there. I mean, ultimately, what Levin is doing is the study of how organisms attain and retain shape, as in how they go from a cell to a given to having a given shape, a number of limbs and so forth, and how they stay that way. Well, ultimately, if you think of aging as drifting away from that state, his work seemingly could help with aging. And also you could point here that planarians don't seem to age. So that's another one Amol has been studying. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So maybe just like slightly changing our bioelectrical field or something, and then our cells will age slower. I don't know what the treatment would look like.
Yeah, it's a good question. I don't really have a good answer of how it would translate to humans or what the therapeutic approach would look like. For example, you say like, how does one change the bioelectric field? I think in worms, you can maybe add something to their water, and then somehow, how do you do it to the liver?
It's
something I definitely want to look into, as to see exactly what would something for aging look like there. But right now I have no.
So that's one of the fields that you think will produce one of a new paradigm shifting or a breakthrough research. Have there been any breakthrough researchers that have like happened recently that you're really excited about, or something in biology that surprised you?
I mean, there are things here and there. I have at least one paper that showed that cancer cells kind of steal mitochondria from other cells, which is kind of like there's like going in, there's like bullies growing, stealing stuff. It sounds kind of weird.
So is that because cancer cells want more mitochondria, or why do they do that?
Apparently, it's like they need them. It's like, hey, why not? It's like, well, cells can exchange mitochondria with each other.
Okay.
And maybe if a cell signals, hey, I need more mitochondria, then their cells will just give it to that cell. And the cancer cell is just like saying, hey, give me all your mitochondria. And she's like, sure, have them.
And then when you give up your mitochondria, do you like lose a lot of power as a cell? Like, do you start dying faster? I would assume so.
As the meme goes, the mitochondria is the power of
how. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I would assume.
Yeah. Intriguingly, there's this thing called the Warburg effect, which is that cancer cells actually rely not so much on mitochondrial energy, but on glycolysis. So cells can make ATP or energy in three ways, glycolysis, fermentation, or exploiting their enslaved mitochondria, free mitochondria. But surprisingly, they are not doing that. They are using glycolysis. Some people speculate that it might be because glycolysis also helps produce some kind of small molecule that then gets used in other pathway to synthesize more molecules, because cancer cells just want to grow a lot.
Okay.
It's not fully clear why they do it. T cells also do Warburg effect and glycolysis. So it's unclear why they want the mitochondria. Maybe just like grab them just to have them just in case. I don't know. But that was one of the weird findings that of recent times. I guess reprogramming itself, it's something not that old. It's from like 5 years ago, the first big reprogramming paper. Then we have, of course, all these CRISPR papers that just keeps getting better. What other things are there that are interesting? And probably if I went to my blog, to my links section, I'll probably find a few of these.
Is there anything like outside of the human body that you're really interested in terms of biology, like synthetic biology?
Well, there is a gene circuits that seem interesting. And the circuit seems to me, I guess like the TLDR here is that the usual farm approach is to take a pill or some sort. There is this molecule in there that goes into your gut, it gets absorbed, typically through your liver, and then it goes to all your cells and it does something. Mm-hmm. But what if you want to very precisely target something? I guess, let's say you want to go to the liver, to this kind of cell type, and do one specific thing instead of going everywhere. Well, you have a problem there with the typical approach. With a gene circuit, you could make it so that if only certain conditions are met, a given gene gets expressed. This is how our own body regulates itself. So you could say, for example, there is this protein called P53 that we have, and it's a tumor suppressor. So you could, this protein detects damage in a broad sense and says, well, if the cell looks like it's going down the cancer route, just kill the cell. That's a circuit. So you could say if gene A is upregulated and gene B is up and gene B is down, then activate this protein and then cause apoptosis. Can we improve upon this? Can we, for example, create universal cancer therapies based on this? Can we make a better p53 circuit? Or you could say if the cell is making too much of this protein, then start producing this other one to be able to clear up this kind of damage. So you could make sort of like conditional based therapies instead of just like bluntly elevating the concentration of some drug, like let's say rapamycin, be able to tightly regulate that.
It feels like bringing computation into the body, like if then statements, essentially.
Yeah, I mean, that's exactly.
Or logic gates.
Yeah, I mean, that's ultimately, there's this very interesting book from Uri Allen. It's called Intro to Systems Biology. And it's basically, that's what the book is about. It's about how our genome does regulation of expression of various genes. For example, you could have a circuit that goes, if the expression of gene A is up, then decrease expression of gene B. And then another one that says, if expression of gene B is up, then reduce gene A. So you have this pattern where you have like gene A goes up and B goes down, and then, but now their circuit turns up and then, so they basically flip like up and down. It's like kind of in a periodic equilibrium. Mm-hmm. Or you could have others that are more conditional. So you have all sorts of this like very control theory based thinking that you can apply there.
And then with gene circuits, can you like change what the equilibrium levels are?
Yeah, that'll be the idea, depending on probably on which promoters you are using to regulate expression of which genes. Or you could do, for example, if the expression of this gene is, if there's too much expression, then this circuit gets activated. Maybe this gene activates the circuit itself, and then the circuit will produce something to inhibit either the gene or the circuit that's actually producing the gene or the protein in the first place.
Okay. And so you mentioned universal therapy for cancer. And so this is like one of your hot takes is that instead of having individualized cancer therapies for each type of cancer, we'll just have one treatment for all of cancer.
That's right.
That's using gene circuits, or can you expand on that?
Yeah. So I guess the idea here is that maybe to put some context here, the field of oncology, there are maybe two broad directions that it is going in. One is early detection and screening, being able to, I guess, if you detect cancer really early, you're playing in easy mode. It's easier to treat when it's small. When cancer is already advanced, you are effectively fucked. So one approach here is you could say, well, what if we sequence patients, their DNA and the tumors themselves, to try to then match patients to specific drugs that maybe work better for those mutations and for those patients? So that's the whole precision oncology or precision therapy approach. So I guess, for example, if you're a biotech, you could say, well, we're going to develop a drug to target this mutation in these patients, and then that could actually, that's very profitable. That's actually, you make lots of money from that. But I was thinking, well, these things are not going to be that effective ultimately, because cancers mutate. So cancers are undergoing lots of mutations as they grow and evolve. So it could be that you use this precision approach and then you kill some cancer cells, but the leftover cancer cells will then, that didn't have a different mutation, will then now replicate and take over. And now you have a different cancer. Mm-hmm. So what to do instead? So from our first principles point of view, what is a cancer cell or what is cancer? So the one answer is, well, cancer is cancers. It's multiple diseases that are very different, but it's like, no, that's true. Sure.
That's the old paradigm.
Well, that's the most accepted paradigm is that it's various kinds of diseases that have some commonalities that people refer to as the hallmarks of cancer. But mechanistically, every cancer, they have to do one thing: to replicate fast and make lots of copies. That's the, you don't do that, you're not a cancer cell. Or rather, you're a benign cancer, so we don't really care much.
Yeah.
Okay, so the chemotherapy, what chemotherapy does is to preferentially go or attack those cells that happen to replicate fast. It's also why you see issues with losing your hair follicles. People go bald with some chemotherapy, because the cells also sometimes look like replicating fast. And so eventually an easy way to kill all cancer cells is to have a super high dose of chemotherapy. The problem is that then you also kill the patient. Killing cancer is easy, but it's not killing everything else.
Yeah, a gunshot kills cancer.
Yeah, exactly. That's
the meme.
Yeah, it's like chemotherapy is like a carpet bombing with nuclear weapons all over. Sure, you're killing the cancer, but you're also killing everything else.
Yeah.
Okay, so if you could say, okay, well, if you're a cancer cell, you probably need lots of energy, probably lots of ribosomes, which sort of ribosomes produce all proteins. You need lots of those. So probably, I said, there's only a limited number of ways in which if you're a cell, you're going to be producing energy and more proteins. Mm-hmm. So there has to be a universal signature that all cancer cells share, or that you could pick up. And the reason why it is difficult to see, I guess, is that if you're only looking at one mutation or one driver mutation, this is going to be different in its cancer type. But no matter of why it's happening, the outcome, which is fast replication and production of more proteins than usual, has to be common, almost by virtue of the definition of cancer. Mm-hmm. And so then you could imagine that you could build a circuit that says, if and or some conditions, then kill the cell. So you could pick on this pattern to then kill any cancer type. That would be
just write a quick script.
Yeah. I guess the challenge here would be, one, what does the circuit look like? I guess you could think of like we already have circuits like this, so it's not like something completely new. So we have two tumor suppressor circuits already built in, and so do other animals. Maybe we can borrow this thing from other species that are cancer resistant, like naked mole rats. We can just like take that into humans, but maybe do it in mice first.
Yeah.
Maybe we could engineer some kind of gene therapy that's basically delivering this into our cells, this mechanism. I don't know, but this
would deliver the gene circuit.
Yeah, you deliver a strand of RNA that basically does all of this into the cells. And an advantage of this would be that if you genetically engineer an organism to have this mechanism, if there's a mutation in a cell that block that stops the mechanism from working, you're screwed because your anti-cancer universal therapy is broken now. Mm-hmm. But if you're delivering it externally, doesn't matter, if you can just keep pumping all of this into the cells. As long as it's high efficacy, so it only gets activated in cancer cells, you're fine.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that would obviously come with fine tuning it. Has anybody tried implementing that gene circuit from a naked mole rat into a mice or mouse?
Not that one. There is a closely related work. So naked mole rats, there are various reasons why people, I guess, like for context, if you take naked mole rat cells and irradiate them with lots of radiation and do the same thing to mice cells, the mice cells may either die or become cancer cells. Naked mole rats just don't care about the radiation. They repair and they keep going.
Do they get damaged? Or because I know some, what are those really small? You can have radiation protected genes.
Yeah, I mean maybe think of tardigrades.
Tardigrades. Yeah.
I mean so when they get damaged, they will die. They will just rather die than become cancer cells. Apoptosis. So one of the reasons why people think that they may be so resistant is because they have these in-between cells in the so-called extracellular matrix. There is this compound called hyaluronic acid or hyaluronan. In naked mole rats, you have very high molecular weight hyaluronan. And you could say, well, the thing that's making this is this protein called hyaluronan synthase. What if you take the gene and you put it in mice and then you get them to have to look like more like a naked mole rats? Or there's a lab working on that. That's the lab of Vera Gorovnova in the UK. And literally is modifying mice to be more like naked mole rats. And we'll see when the research is ongoing, and we'll see it, I guess, later this year or next year.
Okay. But I'll definitely have to get him on the podcast. That sounds interesting. Cool. It's pretty hard to convey this stuff to the public. Like, it's pretty hard to have biotech aesthetics explained really well. Like, you need these memes, like gunshot wound, like a gunshot will kill a cancer cell. Like, that's a good bio meme.
Yeah, I think meme engineering is key in general.
Yeah. I guess, like, do you think about this when you write your posts? Like, do you ever make memes around your posts?
I mean, internally, I think that someone bestowed upon me the title of an honorary Gen Z for like basically thinking on memes all the time. That's cool to think on memes. And on Twitter, I will meme a lot of various bio concepts. When I write posts, I may do some, for example, when I wrote about NFTs, I think I had something like NFTs, but this is like, not that ones, the other ones.
Okay.
Like that.
Still references. Okay, I see.
Yeah, but I think that just using like metaphors, sometimes these metaphors might be kind of very vague and wishy-washy, but sometimes they can actually be useful in making analogies. I guess for example, the thing with the epigenome, I guess it's easier to visualize this idea of like you have molecules, they may go to your DNA and transcribe or not a gene, depending on if it can physically access the gene, and that's easy to see. You have a finger and then it's kind of like expressed or not.
Yeah.
And this is, in my opinion, less obscure than some explanations you might see in some papers that are like very hard to see what's going on.
Yeah. You could definitely make a meme of like some kid holding a cookie or something and not giving it up to a bully or I don't know, whatever. Like, and that's the epigenome protecting itself.
Yeah, I think the ultimate crossover we need to get, I don't know if you know Eliana Shiki, who's doing YouTube videos of aging to get.
Oh, yeah. Her videos are great. Yeah, her videos are great. So like what else? I think we just had until three, but I mean, if you want to keep talking, if that's fine with you, like, I guess what else is exciting? Like if you were going into engineering, what would you study right now? Cause I definitely have a younger audience, like an engineering in school audience.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, I guess for context, I studied aerospace engineering. I did a master's in industrial engineering and then aerospace. My initial plan was to go to SpaceX to build rockets. And then I'm thinking about longevity. So,
Then you wrote a book on the Soviet economy.
That's right.
Yeah, you just do all these random things and then you ended up in longevity and maybe that'll change.
Yeah, who knows?
Yeah.
I mean, it's like, well, from the time you get interested in things and then just follow whatever seems interesting and you end up producing all this stuff. Engineering, so, well, initially I wanted to do CS, but my parents discouraged me from doing CS because they thought it had no future. Very interesting. And I probably would think that I ended up going to a very like generic engineering because I didn't know what to do. But maybe right now I'll go back. I'll probably do some more bio-oriented thing. I don't know if bioinformatics or bioengineering or something like that might be interesting, I guess. It also depends on personality, I guess. If you want like fast feedback and working with computers, you're probably going to be doing comp bio or something like that instead of like wet lab work. Mm-hmm. And I guess this is one of my broader like life thesis, like life learnings, that what matters maybe is not so much if you like it or if you can do it, but more will your personality let you do it? And if you need to work, for example, here's another example. In my first job was working in an electric car factory as an engineer, which sounds cool in the afternoon, right? Electric cars, right? Tesla. But no, it's actually a very old school place. Everyone was like over 40 or 50. Like veterans from the industry, and it felt boring. It was like super slow moving. But then again, you take the same job, and I mean, let's say in the context of Tesla, it's like more fast paced, and then it becomes fun and something you want to do. And just because you have this, you just want to move fast. That happens to be my personality. But if you're okay with taking things slow, then maybe you can actually do more things that require more patience, like pipetting things around in a way.
Yeah, maybe we'll have pipetting automated soon. Hopefully, at least. I also wanted to ask about, what do you think about these like blood transfusion startups? This is a very hot topic.
So I actually recently met with one of the advisors of one of these startups. So there are a number of these. There was Ambrosia, which they were doing blood transfusions from young patients. There is Alkahest, where they are trying to find out specific factors in young blood that might help with aging. It's a company that was acquired by Grifols, which is a Catalan company and the world's largest plasma provider, I guess, random fact. And there's another company called Nugenics, not eugenics, Nugenics, based in somewhere.
I don't know. Risky name.
Risky name, which they did this treatment in mice. I think Horvath was in that paper, and they showed some results, and it's kind of sketchy. I guess like they're like two or three different paradigms in this whole blood stuff. And initially, the initial finding was if you take old mice and young mice and you connect their circulatory systems together, seemingly the young mice gets older in some measures and the younger one gets older in some other measures. It's like, what's going on? So one thinking is, well, maybe there's something in young blood that's good, but option B, maybe there's something in old blood that accumulates and you're going to dilute. So these are the two things that it's like either lack of something or either accumulation of something. Mm-hmm. And it seems to be both. There are some papers that look at the, for example, one treatment is you take old mice, then you basically do a plasma apheresis, which is you take their blood out, you clean it up, you put it back in, like no, you're not adding any new factor. And that also causes some measure of rejuvenation. Another one, if you take albumin, albumin is the most common protein in plasma and in your blood, and it's a nutrient carrier. If you inject, albumin gets damaged as we age. It gets sugars and things stick to it and other things. If you inject freshly made into old mice, they seem to restore the... each paper looks at different things, but younger, some measures. And so you have all these different findings that you have like young factors clearing out or purifying old blood and replacing albumin. And all of these things seem to work depending on what you look at. Now the challenge is, what is it actually that these things are doing or are not doing? What are the limitations of this approach? This is something we actually want to explore in the rejuvenome. We want to see how systemic these effects are.
Okay, so is one of your tests going to be blood transfusion?
Something in that regard. It might be either, you could even do a blood donation. So if you just take blood out, you are in a way that if you assume that there are, let's say, misfolded proteins in your blood, you are diluting the damage because you're taking those away.
Yeah. So can't you, and then what do you backfill it with? Like NaCl or okay.
You don't. Oh, well, you could, but you don't have to. I mean, in humans, when you donate blood as a human, you don't get anything back, right? You're
just out. Yeah.
I mean,
I thought there was something about like diluting it with saline or something like that.
Yes. So in that side, they did replace it with saline. But again, it's like, you don't necessarily have to. In humans, when you donate, you don't get replaced the volume by some saline. You just have less blood. Yep. And then your body will make the extra blood that's needed.
So you think it's like a good approach and it will be continued?
Yeah, I think it should be explored for various reasons. One, it shows some promise in mice. And second, there's some mechanistic story as to why this might be working. This doesn't seem to be a fluke. And then third, it's cheap and easy, and it's already FDA approved. All of these things, like blood transfusions, apheresis, all of this is already FDA approved. Mm-hmm. You don't need to go through any very expensive thing. So if you show it that it works, it should be easy to set up a startup doing like a clinic doing this at scale with an MD doing like off-label plasma apheresis.
Yeah. So are you going to start a funding startup soon? Like, and what kind of startups would you like to see?
Well, I mean, me personally, I have my hands full funding science instead.
Yeah.
Startups that I'd like to see, hopefully more hard tech startups. I guess hard tech startups in general have the problem that they require more commitment than SaaS startups in that, well, sometimes like you have higher upfront capital costs. You cannot just scale. Maybe the playbooks are not as clear. You need a physical space. You cannot do them from your bedroom. You need a physical space in a warehouse or something for your staff, or contracting with a lab. The physical world is messy, ultimately. And I would like to see work in general and to some extent, there is already work on this, on tooling for bio. I think things like if you could have more AWS for biology, that would be great to be able to run tests remotely. I'm sure there are things like Emerald Cloud Labs that kind of like this already. More therapeutics, more like if someone did this universal cancer therapy, that would be great. Maybe I don't know what that's it. In the next 2 years, I may actually just do it myself. Once I get a green card and I'm able to do other kind of
work. Oh, so you'll start a startup soon. That's exciting.
In the next 2 or 3 years, we'll see. So currently, science funding in the future, when science it's properly funded, well, if that's ever true, maybe something else. I also want to see more work in aerospace. So currently, sure, rockets, we have, I guess, like, we maybe for a long time, we thought of rockets are as like, well, you know, they go up, they go down, they launch stuff, and then they break down. And then SpaceX says, it doesn't have to be like that. They could be 10x cheaper. Now you have companies like Boom Technologies doing supersonic flight. Mm-hmm. But what's next? We want like more companies doing a cinema. Just like we have Boeing and Airbus doing airplanes, we want to have more companies in the same space that Boom is doing supersonics, as well as companies thinking about hypersonics, taking it to Mach 5 and beyond. So mm-hmm. you could do, and there's actually a company that was announced a few days ago doing Mach 12. I mean, to Mach 12.
Is that Venus?
Venus, yes.
Yeah, Venus is cool.
Yeah, there was some interesting work a few days ago doing something about like frozen detonation. Apparently, I need to read more about this, but some people were claiming that you could enable also hypersonic flight as well. There is also potentially batteries. So batteries, we want them for not only for electric cars, but also for energy storage. And renewable energy is great in that it's right now in some areas it's cheaper than nuclear, coal, or other sources of energy. But when people look at this chart of energy costs, those costs depend on the energy mix. So as you add more eolic and solar to the mix, those costs actually increase because you need to add batteries to deal with the variability of costs. So at that point, you want more nuclear energy or geothermal or batteries.
Yes.
To cover for that.
Yeah, I love geothermal energy. Are there any like nuclear startups that do you think fusion or fission? Which one are you more bullish on?
Well, I think that maybe a year or two ago, we had said fusion. I guess fusion I'm maybe particularly excited about because there are multiple, maybe 6 or 7 or more startups working on radically different approaches. You have doing like Commonwealth doing a smaller tokamaks. You have a startup doing more like inertial fusion. You have like General Fusion. You have Helion. You have 3Alpha. You have also or Tide. You have different approaches, and we just need one of them to work. Maybe everything is fake news except one. Well, if one works, we have fusion. Fission has a bunch of advantages. One is less. Fission was born in a way with some ties to like the military and like nuclear bombs. It became kind of scary associated with like these big scary reactors. fusion will be started from a clean slate. Reactors cannot be used for nuclear proliferation, which is a concern some have. Cost might be cheaper than fission. And then the fuel story, well, I don't know if we have more hydrogen, hopefully we can eventually, this will be maybe one use case for eventually going to the stars to get some hydrogen from, you know, we have Jupiter, it's like this blue of hydrogen there, it's like we could get some for fusion or from the moon, that helium-3. But maybe one advantage is that you don't need to overcome the political and social resistance to fission energy. Although for fission, even though it's getting expensive, there is now a set of startups that are working on smaller, more modular reactors. So I guess the problem with fission is that costs have been going up historically because you need this like big reactor designs. But what if you could, I guess the one pony trick we have to make things cheap is assembly lines. You put something in an assembly line, it becomes cheaper. If you can make lots of it, just like solar. Mm-hmm. So what if you could make reactors in an assembly line, just like churning hundreds and thousands of nuclear reactors every year or month? And that should bring down costs. And some of these startups are focusing on precisely that. And then maybe we could need some rebranding. I think, I don't know where I saw this, someone was proposing to rebrand nuclear and to put it along with renewables as, and calling it like elemental power, not fission, elemental power. That
sounds cool. I like that.
Maybe you take these like clunky reactors, you make them look cool and you call them elemental energy. And maybe that overcomes a social.
Yeah. I mean, Oklo's doing a good job on the branding. For sure. Like their housing is very sleek.
Yeah, exactly. I was thinking precisely of Oakley. It's like super futuristic, like housing. I think it looks like something out of some video game or something. But yeah, definitely that's what we want to go for. Not only NIM engineering, but also vibe engineering. It has to strike people in the right way.
Yeah, aesthetic engineering.
Yes.
Yes, definitely. And so that's kind of like also cozy futurism versus cool futurism. A little bit. Yeah, so that's one of your memes. Yeah, explain that.
That's one of the memes I want to engineer. There's this idea that I was thinking one day, when we think of the future, I think imagine the future. What do you imagine? Something that maybe comes to mind, partly from science fiction. I mean, if you have watched Star Trek, you think of spaceships, or teleportation, for example. But then you think it's like, well, the Starship Enterprise, you have these very small quarters and then everything is very kind of septic and like plain. It doesn't feel, I mean, ultimately a spaceship, like quarters are limited. Or even if you look at the more hard sci-fi, like The Expanse, which is a great series, it's also kind of very, well, cyberpunky kind of thing.
It's like lived in.
Huh?
It's like lived in, like they've used the environment, like they're living there. It's kind of dirty, right?
Yeah, it's dirty, but also... It's also like if you were to design those environments purely for living, it would probably look different. So the idea of cozy futurism was to say, okay, well, if you could make like a shopping list for if you could say the year is 2100, we're in the future, what do you see? And when you start writing, we have fission reactors and fission is great now. We have flying cars and we have the starships. But then there are other things that seemingly are important to it and get lost. Like there is no poverty, there's houses are nice, we have more space for other things. And we have, let's say, food cooking robots, aging is solved. The idea of cozy futurism was simply thinking, if you take your own life, what would you actually use? What would make your own life nicer? And then seeing what technology could get you there. It, in a way, it's a reaction to thinking of, there is a sense in which, it's something I definitely subscribe to, in which something we want to achieve as a species is to this grand set of achievements of like going to the moon, for example. Something I've said before is that the Apollo program was the world's largest arts project, in that it was a huge aesthetic move and greatly inspirational for generations of engineers to come. Mm-hmm. But it's like usefulness, not really. It's like
stepped on the moon.
But the point was not to be useful. The point was to achieve the thing itself. It's like when you're playing a video game, part of the point is to do this, to have fun playing the video game, or even in life. What's the point of life? Is to maybe weave an interesting story, achieve interesting things, so and so forth. But everything is for that. So, and maybe we have these terminal goals, like maybe like building Dyson spheres and like ring worlds. But then we have all these other things that like, hey, ultimately people have hunger and they die. And we want to solve those basic concerns.
So cozy futurism is like making your life actually better. And cool futurism is like doing really cool things.
Yeah, which they can be tied, of course. It's like solving aging. It sounds like it requires some very cool bioengineering to get there. But also you are, and plus you're also, if there's like, just like mankind has wanted to go to the, well, first we wanted to fly like birds and having wanted to solve from millennia, and we did that, then we wanted to go to the stars, well, not there yet, but we got to the moon. That's a starting point.
Yep.
Living forever has been, or for a long time has been, if you all the way back to the epic of Gilgamesh from the Babylonian times, that has been there. Mm-hmm. And so in a way, solid longevity is the next moon landing, or as I see it. So that's also, it's part of that cool thing, kind of cool inspirational achievement that is also helpful. But you could also think that another framing or another point I wanted to make with the Cozy Futurism article is that maybe for a technical audience, we like technical challenges. For example, you could say, well, housing policy, that's maybe not a technical challenge because, well, we know how to build houses. Maybe we find cool when these companies like Bro that can build the skyscraper super fast in China. But housing policy itself, just like enabling people, letting people build, that doesn't seem exciting because that's just need to convince people to let you do it. There doesn't seem to be any breakthrough of interest there.
It's more of a political thing.
Yeah, it's a mere political thing, but that mere is doing a lot of work there. Actually, we want those mere political changes to unlock radical improvements in the quality of living of a lot of people. So my framing with quasi futurism is like we should not abandon cool futurism. We should also think that, hey, there are other things. This is another lens which we need to look at progress and technology.
Okay. So it's another way to like solve the political system, or sorry, can you like expand on that?
Yeah, I mean, it's a way, in as much as you can, let's say, imagine a better future and then use that as a guiding star to go there and decide on what to work on. And the cozy futurism lens is another kind of future you can imagine, and then you would work maybe on a different set of things. I mean, ultimately, those two things are related. So maybe you may want to work on housing policy instead of trying to build houses in a factory like prefab housing. You could say like, oh, this is cool to be able to like build skyscrapers in a month. It's cool. But it's like, well, if they don't let you build them, what are you going to do with this fancy technology? So you also need to solve for the social constraints.
I see. Yeah. Nice. Is there anything else you wanted to talk about?
Maybe we could talk about, I guess it's good. I think we have an hour or 2 hours. Oh, wow. 2 hours. And I think it's good. It's a good set of things. We can probably.
Yeah. I think it was like an hour and 20 minutes.
So yeah.
Awesome. Yeah. Cause I think that was basically like, we talked about a ton of biotech, and that's what you think is like the next endless frontier, or the current endless frontier, or the endless frontier.
Yeah. Oh, yes. I guess that's another good topic to finish. Yeah. So there is this view that physics was this great engine of progress during the past century. We had you could point to like things like semiconductors or fission energy itself, or GPS, or all sorts of things, development of general relativity and quantum mechanics. And now it seems that physics is kind of like not delivering as much as it used to. So you could take it as like, well, maybe there's something broken in physics. Maybe we want to change the way, maybe we want to fund crazier physicists than the one we are currently funding. And there are some proposals to this extent that Lee Smolin, a physicist, he says that maybe if we fund like 200, the 200 or 20 most interesting people in the field for life, that should be enough to get some progress there. But there's also a view that maybe we have already discovered a lot of physics, that we have discovered most of what is going to be useful. And of course, this might be wrong. People have said many times in the past that science is complete and then something new comes in. Mm-hmm. But it does seem that, as a matter of fact, in the last few decades, physics has not really delivered much. By physics, I mean fundamental physics. I do think that material sciences, especially in battery research, as well as future advances in things like topological matter, which is like leveraging very weird quantum effects. I don't fully understand, but that seems to be one potential area of future interest.
Yeah.
I'm referring to fundamental physics. I think sure, eventually we might unify these fundamental theories of physics, but that might not be useful for engineering purposes. So it may be a cool achievement, but not a cozy achievement in the framing. Biology, on the other hand, we're seeing month after month new radical advances, both in tooling, new therapies being approved, new things we're not being able to do before, and we see them over and over and over. And this is if anything, this is speeding up. So whereas in other fields, you may point to a stagnation in biology, at least as far as the rate of progress is concerned, we are seeing a golden age of biology. And so
this is another one of your hot takes, is that the narrative on the great stagnation is that, well, actually it's just maybe in some places, but biology is definitely not stagnating.
If we are fixed with a given some number of fields and those are slowing down, then it maybe looks like everything is slowing down, but maybe other fields are actually speeding up. So I guess then we turn to the question of why some fields are speeding up and why are others slowing down, which mm-hmm. then gets into what are the bottlenecks of all these different fields? Because maybe you go to to one of his like second fields, and then the scientists say like, well, if only we had $10 million for this experiment, then we could make so much progress, but no one's giving us the money. Maybe you want to give them the money for that one experiment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. But biology is the endless frontier right now.
Yeah, it does seem like biology is the hot field to be in. I guess like if you think of physics feels like a city in that, you know, well, cities are building new things, but you know, more or less where everything is, right? There are different neighborhoods and so on. Biology feels like the Wild West. It's like biology basically feels like you take the train to the frontier, and then the train tracks end and you're left in the middle of nowhere. No one knows what's going on. You don't know what's there. They're, and you're exploring and finding out new things all the time. There's like, it's like a gold rush, but for biology, I guess.
It feels like crypto right now. Crypto feels like the Wild West for sure.
I guess like crypto, you could make maybe it's I guess like coins going to the moon. You have biotech stones on the moon maybe. But yeah, it definitely feels like that. It's a free for all sort of like new things coming up all the time. It's like you have NFTs or nifties, which you should call them nifties definitely. You have a lot of new things coming up in bio as well all the time.
Nice, that's exciting. Well, maybe I definitely want to know who else you think I should talk to on the podcast. So maybe you should send me a list or something of some cool researchers. I think that would be excellent. Because I think biotech communication to the like broader public is just really difficult, but I think that's like a really important problem to solve.
Yeah, I guess. Yeah, I guess that's maybe send me an email with a reminder for that. And I can try to think of some people. Maybe if you have some fields in mind. I can try to find someone. I guess, for example, the guy that did that was the first author on the Sinclair study that they did the mice. We are Twitter mutuals, so I can try to slide into his DMs.
Okay. I think I also have a connection to Sinclair, so I think I'll try to get him on the podcast as well. Yeah. I think that would do well.
Yeah, I think I did talk to Sinclair, and he was super busy. And he was actually, this is something that people, I don't know if you have had this experience, people in the longevity space, they sometimes start working out as they talk to you on Zoom. So they're like lifting weights and they're talking to you.
No way. I haven't experienced that yet.
Sinclair did that actually.
That's like, funny.
It's like
he's like deadlifting while you're trying to like talk about my
stuff. Like machines when you're like doing like, it's like
lap pulls. Like,
Yeah.
Speaking of that, do you do anything specific for your longevity?
Intermittent fasting. So I will have like in the form of, I have breakfast, lunch, and then no dinner until the next day. So lunch maybe 12 or 1 p.m. and then nothing until the next day. Maybe some tea, some Diet Coke, well, zero Coke, which is better. And that's it. Then broadly trying to eat healthy. So what that lunch and breakfast might be is Huel, which is a vegan meal replacement. That's less like Soylent, but it tastes better and is nutritionally complete. I guess there's an interesting thing here in that some people, when they switch to a carnivore or keto diet, they report feeling better. But then maybe sometimes what's good for longevity is not what makes you feel better. It's what makes you feel bad. I mean, feeling hungry all the time doesn't feel good, but actually what works for longevity. So maybe there are always trade-offs here between short-term and longer-term. I mean, if you ask, for example, like Celine or Laura or David Sinclair himself, people do all sorts of different things. And with Sinclair, for example, he's older, so he takes some supplements. Older, you're younger, so it's not like we have anything broken to repair or replenish.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think that as long as the basics are covered, like doing some exercise, eating relatively healthy, not being overweight, maybe the one thing that you could do is fasting in the form of intermittent fasting seems to be the one. There are also randomized trials in humans of intermittent fasting. It seems to work as promised, at least for according to some biomarkers. So that's the one that seems actionable. I do not take myosin or metformin. If I ever consider doing it, I would do it under an MD supervision to actually with regular blood tests to make sure it's working. I also did a brief experiment with a keto diet last month, and I did this. I do believe in an N of one experiments where you do a blood test, measure, do something, measure
just
again.
Like corn. Yeah.
Yeah. I think ultimately your genes are your genes, and what works for you may not work for someone else. I mean, like all these studies, they're averages of what works for various people. And probably for some people, some things work and for some people they don't. I mean, for example, in that case, the keto diet I was doing did not increase my LDL cholesterol. But maybe it will increase for someone else and they actually do it. So you have to just measure and see what it does.
Yeah. But you don't want to increase your LDL.
No, LDL, you want it to go down.
Yeah.
I mean, I guess the worry with with keto is that you're eating lots of fat and maybe that can raise your cholesterol and maybe that's bad but that didn't happen in my own case.
Okay. Yeah. Well, maybe it was because you were also fasting.
It's not even fasting.
Maybe people that go on keto like don't fast and then it's just overload and then yeah, it's just brutal, too much.
Yeah, it may also be that my keto was you can do the frying a steak in butter and eating it every day, or you can do like coconut milk and salmon.
Yeah,
maybe clean keto.
Yeah,
and maybe that's the difference. I guess for milk, for example, I recall that there is something called the milk glomerular membrane. It's apparently when you have milk or yogurt, the way that fat gets metabolized, it's different from the way the fat in butter gets metabolized. And apparently that's why yogurt doesn't really increase LDL, but butter apparently does.
That's interesting.
It's all fat coming from dairy, but apparently it's not quite the same.
Yeah.
I guess like nutrition is a clusterfuck because of this reason, because every person is their own thing. So you have to, if you want to fine tune, you have to experiment and then blood tests.
Yeah.
There's a website called, there are many, I mean, we can plug them later. I get no money from them, but there are these labs like Quest and LabCorp that may be very expensive to get tests from. Mm-hmm. But there are websites that you can get tests in the same places, but cheaper. And there's like blood tests.
Yeah, I think SciFox is working on like at-home blood tests where you can measure these kind of levels at home. I think that's super important.
Yeah, I mean, it's like it's Theranos, but for real. And in the UK, there's this company called Medicheck, and they send you this kit. You get this finger prick test, and you get your LDL and all sorts of things, and so you don't have to visit any lab.
Yeah, that'll be one of the biggest tools. That'll be huge. And then once you can start collecting that data and integrating it with like what people eat, assuming that what people eat and track is like accurate, then you'll get some good data. But it's hard.
Yeah, I think that we have to. So right now we have lots of things you could use for monitoring. You have, most famously, these continuous glucose monitors, right? Like from levels. Mm-hmm. You have the blood tests. You can look at LDL, inflammation, and other things. What we are missing, perhaps, is the interventional aspects. For example, right now, well, if you have a CGM, you have a bunch of things, and now what? Well, but you could have, on top of having the CGM, you could say, okay, well, today try this diet and see what it does. And then next day try this sort of thing and see what it does. And then you could be fine tuning depending on the response to these various items. For example, maybe today you eat just grapes and then tomorrow you eat a steak and then next day you fast. And then they could use the data to match your profile to other people's profiles and then see exactly what your personalized response to those things is. Because right now it's up to you to experiment and find out. So we need help with the interpretation of all this data to see exactly what you should or should not do.
Yeah. Do you think blood type has a big impact on that kind of stuff, on nutrition?
My guess would be no, but I have not looked into it.
This is kind of out there, but like, for example, I know in Japan, people treat blood type like astrology signs.
That's true. They do, yes. I don't know why it started, but I don't know if there is something to it.
Yeah, but I would assume like there's a little bit more to it than obviously astrology, but I know that there aren't too many studies on how your blood type affects your nutrition and stuff like that, but I think that'd be interesting to look into.
Yeah, I guess there's like a galaxy brain take on astrology and how it could be quote true. I think if for example, if you are, let's say, Libra, you were born in a given month, that month happened to be maybe colder,
mm-hmm.
and maybe
less sun.
Yeah, or and there was less sun, maybe, and there are some papers that try to point in a direction, maybe they're fake news, but it's like through the effect of the weather and the climate and the temperature and the sun, while you're very, very young, developing, that maybe has an effect later on. Again, it's probably...
This is the same thing with like babies born in August. Their moms had all summer to be tan, and then they got a bunch of vitamin D, so then they're like huge if you're born in August.
It's going to be like a galaxy brain take like this. I mean,
I think it's more like a midwit meme.
It also reminds me
of like Malcolm Gladwell as well. His book on this, Outliers, is what it's called. It's like where hockey players, the hockey season cutoff is January. So if you're born in January, you'll be bigger than the guy that's born in December because you have 12 more months on him. So then most hockey players are born in January through March instead of like December. Yeah. So that's one of those takes. But then people correlate it to astrology.
Yeah. I guess like this is something that I guess in a way that, and I guess maybe there's something actually like really mechanistic about blood types, but I have no idea. I mean, maybe there's something to it. I don't know.
Anyway, we'll have to talk about that next time you're on the podcast. Yeah, because I think we basically talked about everything. So I really appreciate the time. This was really fun. And I'll definitely have all the links in the description. What do you want to plug? What do you want people to check out?
Yeah, so people can find me on my Twitter, which is Arthur Kell, or they can search my full name, or they can search my blog at nintil.com. Awesome. And only one person with my name in the internet, so I should be easy to find.
And you have the awesome longevity FAQ, which is where everybody can look at like the frequently asked questions for longevity.
Yeah, that's right. I have a number of longevity related posts in my blog. There's the data FAQ, there is the intro to longevity, how to fix longevity. And if anyone wants to get both into biology and longevity, I definitely recommend reading the FAQ.
Nice. Yeah, so whenever you publish your results on this rat or on this mice experiment, I definitely want to, you know, talk to you about the results of that. I think that would be really awesome.
Sure. Great.
Awesome. Cool. Thanks for coming on. I appreciate it. Talk soon.
Thanks for having me.
Awesome, guys. So I hope you enjoyed that. Definitely let me know in the comments what you thought, if you're researching in longevity. And always, as always, tweet at me. I always check my mentions on Twitter. I'm at @Nasjack_. And lastly, I know I took a little break from the podcast, but I was figuring out some life stuff and now I'm getting back into it. And this is going to be definitely my main focus. So let me know if there's anybody you'd want to see on the podcast. And I'm looking forward to improving on the podcast. And I'll see you guys in the next one. Peace.